Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 15th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is John Stabb. Today's session number is STJ-2001-1, and it's titled Claiming Wholeness in the Public Sphere. Let's listen in.
How many have not been in either of my first two sessions? Okay, quite a few. Let me just sort of give an overview then of the topic, and the topic is claiming our wholeness, and this is something that I've come to recently since I've been at St. Francis Lutheran Church. I was serving a church in Philadelphia up until January, called to St. Francis. And as I've said before, whenever you come to a new church, there are all sorts of little idiosyncrasies in the liturgy. People think, well, we do it the standard green book way, but everybody's got their own little thing. And one of the unique things at St. Francis, although it's really kind of a throwback to the old days, is at communion, they dismiss each table individually. We don't have continuous communion. We have, 12 or 15 people come kneel at the communion rail, and then when they've communed, there's a dismissal, and then the next group comes up. The tradition that's developed over the last 7 or 8 years is to say, may the body and blood of Christ preserve you unto life everlasting. Live in forgiveness. Claim your wholeness. Go in peace. And there's something about the phrase "claim your wholeness" that just really kind of resonated with me. I never heard that before, but it's something that I've been thinking about and thinking about. Well, what does wholeness look like? How do we claim it? And as I've thought about that, it's been apparent that there are many different areas of life where we're fragmented and we're not functioning as whole people, and how this is really what we're called to do. The view of humanity in the Hebrew scripture is of whole people, body, mind, and soul together. The Hebrew word is nefesh for the body. That means more than just the body. But there's a wholeness, and also the Hebrew word shalom that you may be familiar with. There's a real fullness of fullness of grace in that. I've been just kind of looking at different ways to think about claiming wholeness. One of the things it means at St. Francis is in the middle of the gayest neighborhood in North America, I'm told. We have probably 70% of our members are gay or lesbian, and what claiming wholeness means for them is to be able to be whole people in church and to be out of the closet and to be who they are in terms of their sexual orientation. And this is a sense of liberation to be sitting, for a gay man to sit in church with his partner, his boyfriend, and be recognized, not have to hide in the closet. So that's a big part of what claiming wholeness means at St. Francis. But I think it really applies to many, many different areas of life. The area I'd like to talk about today is claiming wholeness in the public square, meaning in the public arena where policies are discussed, where we live our life. We don't do that very well here in the United States. I spent some time in Iceland in the fall of 1999 on sabbatical. And one of the reasons I wanted to go there is that it's the most Lutheran country in the world, and it operates in the way that that many of the churches our forebears came from in Scandinavia and Germany, where there's a state church that's supported by the government that everybody belongs to unless they take some action to opt out of it. And that was the case in Iceland. It was just interesting to see that. I really got a sense of the wholeness of the society because of that. In downtown Reykjavik, they have their parliament, the Althing, which is the oldest parliament in the world. It goes back to, I think, 930 A.D. And right across the street from that is the Lutheran Cathedral. I was there at the time when they had the opening of Parliament, and Parliament opened in the cathedral. All the members of Parliament there with the presiding bishop and other bishops, two other bishops of the church. They had their opening Eucharist, and then they marched over to the Parliament building. So there's a real wholeness, a unity between church and state. Obviously, it's not something that has ever been the case here in America. Could never be the case. In Iceland, 95% of the people are Lutheran. 90% belong to the national church, and then another 5% or so belong to the Lutheran Free Church. So that there's a real sense of you know, one people, one church, one nation.
Do they go to church? I don't know, like Norway.
As a matter of fact, they do, and at least they did at the time that I was there. I had initially planned to go in August because the weather is nicer there. And in talking that over by email with a pastor there, he said, "Hey, if you want to experience the fullness of church life in Iceland, don't come in August. You'll come either before Easter or after the middle of September." So that's what I did. I was there from late September through late October, at a time when the Sunday schools were getting all started up again. Confirmation class was starting. And there was full participation every place I went. 80% of 7th and 8th graders in Iceland are in confirmation class. 80% of the children are baptized into the national church. And the church is very much loved because it was really a bulwark of nationalism during the whole time when it was a Danish possession. And the church really preserved Icelandic language and culture and music and things like that. So it's very near and dear to the people. That wasn't the case in Sweden, where the church took a position against the labor movement early in the 1900s. And for that reason, the people really see the church as not supporting that. Yes, sir?
What's the population of Iceland?
About 275,000. So just a little over a quarter of a million. And it's pretty homogeneous. There was very little immigration to Iceland after the initial settlement. Up until World War II, it was the poorest country in Europe, the lowest standard of living, even compared to Albania. Subsistence farming, fishing, and then drying the salt cod was a major export. It was a very poor country. Nobody wanted to go there. And so it really was pretty homogeneous. Since then, their standard of living has increased dramatically since the advent of air travel. As there have been various refugee crises, they've taken their share. There are Vietnamese restaurants in Reykjavik. And while I was there, they had taken in some Bosnian refugees. So there's been some immigration since then. But it's still a very, very homogeneous country.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Anytime you read an article about Iceland, it's the drinking problem and something about their geothermal.
Mm-hmm. They've done wonders with geothermal heat and energy and stuff like that. And I didn't.
You didn't observe the drinking problem.
Not the folks I hung out with. I stayed with Lutheran pastors. And quite frankly, I didn't. I've heard that too, but I didn't see people wheeling in the streets or anything like that. Maybe I went to bed too early. I don't know. But frankly, I didn't see that. But that's another way to organize society. Obviously, different from the way we are here. Here in America, when it comes to matters of faith and religion, it's pretty much don't ask, don't tell. In the workplace. Any sort of public debate in the schools, it's religion, faith is considered to be it's a private matter, it's a personal matter, and you have no business bringing that into the public forum. A politician has no business bringing their faith into a discussion in the state legislature. In the Congress, when that happens, they're criticized, churches are not permitted to make political contributions. This is how Al Gore got in trouble had a fundraiser in a Buddhist temple. I mean, there's got to be complete separation. That's not the case in Iceland. It's very much a unified system. We've been taught this growing up, that we need to have a separation of church and state. That this is sort of the American way, and we've been taught that. We said it's, any sort of interference one way or the other is unconstitutional. It's wrong. We're very sensitive to that. But in our arrogance as Americans, as in most things, we've come to think, well, this is the way it should be. This is the way it ought to be. It works for us. It ought to work for everybody. In our government, there's no appreciation, sensitivity for religious communities for the most part. And I think this has been a very costly thing for us, particularly in the area of foreign policy. We've lived in Washington. I've known people in the State Department. I spent 20 years in the Navy. Reading intelligence dispatches and things like that, and I know that there is no one in the CIA, in any of the intelligence agencies, no one in the State Department specifically assigned responsibility for religious affairs to pay any attention to spiritual things, to spiritual movements, to church in general, because it's not in America, it's not something that the government ought to be paying attention to. It's forbidden, for instance, and has always been, when the census is taken every 10 years, it's forbidden to ask any sort of religious questions, like what church do you belong to, or what any sort of faith-related thing. It's considered a violation of the separation of church and state. The government should have absolutely nothing to do with churches, with people, help people live out their faith life, their worship life. Seems to work pretty well here, but we also apply that same standard to other countries, and nobody is paying attention to faith movements in other countries, and we've suffered for it. In the little blurb I wrote up here, I said how I spent 102 days at sea because the CIA ignored the Ayatollah. This is when it really came home to me. And during the time, just prior to the Iranian Revolution, there was a lot of foment. There were some strikes in the oil fields. There was sort of this building resistance movement against the rule of the Shah. And at the time, I was a combat watch officer on a cruiser. I had a top secret security clearance, and I read all the intelligence dispatches about what was going on and what might happen, because it was a real crisis. We had the cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East was to arm the Shah, and this was a non-Arab Muslim country, a country that was becoming westernized, a country that was friendly to Israel, friendly to the U.S., and we either gave or sold to the Shah's government all of our best military stuff. We sold them warplanes that we wouldn't sell either to Israel or to Saudi Arabia. They were heavily supplied, heavily armed, and our policy was that he would sort of be our guy there. He would sort of police the Persian Gulf area, maintain stability.
But didn't we put him there?
Well, we did. We put his father there. The CIA was involved in the coup back in 1954.
It was a democratically elected organization that the CIA overthrew and put this man in.
Yeah.
That's why we have so much anger toward us, because of them disrupting their history with us.
Absolutely. And I think the intelligence committee was sensitive to that, but there was absolutely no inkling of a mention of this guy, the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was in Paris, who was revered by the Iranian people, who was the spiritual leader of, I guess they're Shiite. No, they're Sunni. They're Shiite Muslims, mostly in Iran. He had tremendous influence through the religious infrastructure there in the mosques, the mullahs, the other Ayatollahs. Not a hint that was even a factor in what was going on. Intelligence reports talked about some revolutionary labor activists, and it really kind of started in the oil fields, and there was a lot of concern about that, and then some demands being made. But the reason that the Shah was overthrown was because he was too Western, because he forbid women to wear the traditional Muslim dress. He permitted men and women to go to school together. He was permitting women to walk on the streets of Tehran in Western style dress. This was the reason he was overthrown, because he had offended the essential traditional religious sensibilities of the people. And our intelligence community didn't have a clue. There was nobody was even paying attention to that. All of a sudden, the Abi Arthur government is put in place. The Ayatollah flies in from Paris, and bingo, he's the guy, you know, to everybody's surprise. It just came as a complete surprise to, and it was just a major, major foreign policy failure and blunder, because I maintain, because of separation of church and state here, nobody in the State Department, the CIA, the government, has any kind of sensitivity to spiritual movement, spiritual life, faith life, religious life. Yes, ma'am.
You know, a Persian person told me that the real reason was that the mullahs controlled the souk, the marketplace, and they got the profits from there, and he had separated them. And so they wanted to show me that it was an economic thing.
Yeah, and that's the argument. People always look for economic explanation for world events, and that's so typical. I heard, attended spent a weekend up at the Bohemian Grove in Northern California a couple of months ago, and one of the speakers there was James Woolsey, who was CIA director under Clinton, in the first part of the Clinton administration. And he talked about sort of why we need to have spies, and even if after the Cold War, you know, why it's important to have intelligence gathering. And I got upset by his presentation, giving sort of the standard explanation for the fall of the Soviet Union, which also came as a big surprise to our intelligence community. Nobody had any. People were surprised when the Berlin Wall came down. Nobody expected it. But the standard explanation, why did the Soviet Union fall? Because they had a crummy economic system, right? They couldn't deliver consumer goods that people wanted. And their economy just didn't work. They couldn't compete with the U.S. And provide both military arms and consumer goods. And that's why the system fell. Isn't that sort of the standard litany that you hear about why we won the Cold War? Hogwash. I worked. Well, first of all, what was wrong with the Soviet Union wasn't that they had a faulty economic system. The Soviet Union truly was the evil empire. They oppressed the religious life of people. They Stalin rounded up all the Lutheran pastors and sent them to Siberia. They converted churches to swimming pools and things like that, and they destroyed. They attempted to destroy the soul of the people. When I was in Philadelphia, I worked very much with Russian refugees and got to work with them. We had some bilingual Bible classes and discovered that certain theological words like redemption and salvation and things like that had been removed from the Russian language. I mean, there were no Russian words anymore for faith-related terms, and to my mind, that was the major failing of the Soviet Union and the reason that it fell. The beginning of the fall was the Solidarity Movement in Gdansk. That was a Catholic supported labor union, and it was their faith that gave them the guts to stand up to the government. And that was sort of the beginning. The Berlin Wall fell mainly because of a religious organized, faith-based protests organized around St. Thomas Kirche in Leipzig. That the East German Lutheran Church was the only opposition and people gathered and prayed and celebrated Eucharist together, praying to be liberated. And that's what changed the system in East Germany. What caused the Soviet Union to eventually fall apart, that the first country that said, we don't want to be in this anymore, was Lithuania. At a great economic cost, but it was based on a strong Roman Catholic identity that again gave them the strength, the spiritual strength to say, we don't care what it costs. We don't want to be a part of this system anymore. They elected a non-communist government, and they said, we're out of here. The Soviet Union said, fine, we're not going to sell you subsidized gas anymore. You have to pay four times what you were paying before for the natural gas that you're getting from the Ukraine. They said, fine. So, you know, it was against all economic good sense, but Lithuania said, we don't want to be a part of this anymore, and because of their strong Roman Catholic faith. And I think once the story comes out, I think it'll be clear that the one person who had most to do with the fall of the Soviet Union was Pope John Paul II, because he provided, and having a Polish pope at all, and having elected a Polish pope, just really encouraged and emboldened the people to break free from this system that oppressed their souls. And in my view, nobody talks about that. It's just about it's the economics. You know, economics is the new religion, and Alan Greenspan is its only prophet. And I think this is just an example of this blind spot that we have as a nation to anything that's related to faith or spiritual movements. If you look at some of our other foreign policy failures, where we really don't know how to operate, it's always in areas where there are religious forces at work that we don't understand. Northern Ireland is a good example of that. Beirut, you know, there's this very complex situation, a religious balance between the Druids and Christians and Muslims, and there's things are starting to unravel. So we say, well, let's, you know, in our innocence and in our arrogance, well, we'll send in some Marines. And we'll just kind of get everybody at the table and say, well, you know, what are the issues? And let's work this out, and let's just solve this problem, and then go home. Completely oblivious to the strong religious motivation that motivates people to become suicide bombers and drive and blow up 230 Marines and themselves. That's just inconceivable to our American way of thinking. We can't understand that. We didn't understand the religious aspects of going into Kosovo and the reverence that the Serbs held towards some particular monasteries that were in Kosovo that are very much a part of their history, a part of their faith, and we just sort of ignored that, didn't really get it. I don't think we have any understanding on how to deal with Osama bin Laden. He's like, you know, the most wanted. I read an article in the current issue of Atlantic Monthly by a former CIA caseworker who says we don't have a clue about what's going on in Afghanistan within this militant Islamic movement. We can't, using this sort of the standard techniques. I mean, there's no way you could plant a spy into an organization like that's fueled by religious fervor. I mean, you can't get people to defect from that because of their strong faith that's a part of the cause. And as you were pointing out, they hate the U.S. And because they see us as the great Satan, as a great secular state, promulgating some of the... How many saw the movie last night at the Forum? About sort of this consumerism and the American movies and just the sort of faithless consumerist sort of gospel. That's why they hate the U.S. and they're willing to blow themselves up to fight that. And nobody in our government really can understand that. And there are no contacts. There's no dialogue going on with religious groups like that around the world. Yes, ma'am.
I think it was in Foreign Affairs that there was the article about the Field of the Blackbirds, and I thought because that was almost sacred to the Serbs, but that was why they didn't want the Albanians or the Muslims in Kosovo. I mean, it made it, in fact, I've read several articles that said that the Field of the Blackbirds was just a holy place and served history, and that was the initial.
Yeah, and that was a rallying point for Milosevic, and he kind of used that for his own purposes.
Okay, so, but it was, of course, also religious difference.
Yeah, but I don't think anybody in our government really, I mean, and they're not trained to understand it. I mean, they're not, you know, government's a bureaucracy, and if we wanted to pay attention to those things, we'd have, sort, you know, within the State Department, sort of a director for religious affairs or something like that to kind of liaison. And we don't. We don't. The Pope is accorded some recognition because technically he's the head of state of Vatican City. And so that's been used. And the Vatican was given diplomatic recognition during the Reagan administration, mainly as a way to counter what some of the liberal American bishops were advocating in terms of social justice and things like that. And Reagan sort of sideswiped them by recognizing the Vatican. Yeah.
Well, I've been puzzling over the fact that the institution of separation of church and state in this country came about, I believe, for a real good reason, for the purpose of allowing space and opportunity and freedom and respect for every religious group without interference. And so this one thing that has made the United States very unique and also created a very pluralistic religious society, maybe one of the most pluralistic or heterogeneous in the world. And consequently, one would think that because we have this great benefit in our society, that that would make us more conscious and more aware of the variety of religious beliefs and opinions and have some sense of respect for them. But from the way I hear you talking, that ironically we have like less or none. Like, as a whole, our society being very secularistic and doing this fragmentation has just simply just removed ourselves from thinking about.
Yeah, religion is irrelevant. I mean, or it's not irrelevant, but it's a private matter. It's a personal matter. It's no business of the government to talk about it, to think about it. It's separate, and we are the rest. Most of the rest of the world is not like this, you know. Saudi Arabia is a major ally. It's against the law to hold a Christian worship in Saudi Arabia. It's an Islamic country. They're the protectors of the holy places in Mecca and Medina. This is who they are. They made some exceptions during the Gulf War. They would not make exceptions for Jewish worship. It was they wouldn't bend on that. We had to fly. They held Jewish services on a amphibious carrier in the Gulf. So and Jewish soldiers that wanted to go to Sabbath services were flown to the carrier. But they absolutely refused. Iceland, it's a Lutheran country. You know, there are a few. You know, the Mormons are there, and you know, in recent years there have been Pentecostals and the Catholics, but it's, you know, church and state are together, and that's the way it is, you know, in a lot of the world, and because that's not the way things are here, we assume it's sort of archaic and wrong, and as in so many aspects of American culture, the way we do it here is the standard, you know, and others, you know, they'll come along eventually. They're just sort of behind the times, and that's not the case at all. Yeah.
But if we had established a religion back in the, you know, the early days, we probably wouldn't have the diversity in this country because they wouldn't have allowed Lutherans in with all those New England Congregationalists and Catholics and.
Yeah, yeah, and there were, and in some of the colonies, I mean, the Episcopal Church was the only church in Virginia, Puritan Church in Massachusetts. There was that, we sort of started out that way, but you know, I'm not. I don't know how we can change it, but I think we're wrong to assume that this is, you know, this is the way things ought to be. This is the best way for things to work. We see this in education, and. you know, more so in recent years in some court cases. Any remember when the teacher used to start the class with prayer? And anybody do that when you were growing up? Some of our students remember when they had the Ten Commandments on the wall of the school. One of the seniors in our church said, "Well, that's when things started going downhill." Is it 11:30?
11:15, you said, didn't you?
Okay, well, that's good. Let me know when it's
11:30. I thought you said that. That'd be 15 minutes of discussion.
Okay,
whatever
good. Yeah, it's just good to know.
You got to go with whatever you want.
But, you know, I don't, you know, so we have increasingly, you know, separated just in my lifetime, recent lifetime. I remember when it was okay for a local clergy, minister or rabbi, to open, say, a little invocation at the high school graduation. You can't do that anymore. It's been ruled, all that's been ruled to be unconstitutional. I don't know that that's better. Education in this country is in big trouble. When I was in Iceland, I visited schools. They teach religion in the schools in kind of a low-key way, mainly Bible stories. And I was interested to see what the curriculum is. The local pastor is invited into the schools to teach. I saw a confirmation class for disabled youngsters being taught in the school by the Lutheran pastor with the help of the classroom teachers that were assigned there. And there's a real unity. The kids learn about David and Goliath. The kids learn the Ten Commandments. They learn the creation story. There's not an attempt to really you pressure them to accept Jesus as their Savior or anything like that, but it's just as an educational enterprise. They're given the background of Christianity as it's a part of their society. Families, if they, for instance, a Roman Catholic family, or and there are a few Buddhists there, if they don't want their kids to attend religion classes, it's okay. They can opt out of it. But again, it's 95% Lutheran, so most of the kids are there. That's part of the fabric of society. I have to say that the classrooms that I observed, those kids were well behaved and had sort of a they were just great Lutheran kids, you know. I was just impressed by how much order and respect there was in the classroom.
But I think that comes from the families rather than I know how much someone in my family objects to even character education in the schools. He said, "That's what I teach them at home."
Yeah, and this is,
it's irresponsible parents who don't teach at mm-hmm. home that cause behavior problems in school.
Yeah, well,
to some degree.
But the parents can't do it alone, you know. And in Iceland, the parents and the church and the school are all speaking the same language, whereas here we're completely fragmented. And what whatever you teach your kids at school, at home, and they take to school, for the most part, they're going to have to stay. They can't talk about it because they don't want to be embarrassed.
Well, and that may well be that they're embarrassed to talk about it. But let me just do a little context here. Mm-hmm. I have taught my entire teaching career at a church-related school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so first at a Catholic high school, now at a college that's affiliated with the Lutheran Church.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very uncomfortable with the idea that says things would be better if we put that stuff in the public schools.
Yeah, I'm not advocating that.
And the problem that I have primarily with that is that I think that our quick presumption is that the things we want taught will be the curriculum. And I don't think that. I think that if you had, because I had some experience with this younger, and I've done some reading on this, I think that the kind of theology that you would get in the schools would not be the theology that you want your children to have. You'd have a very standardized, very, I guess I'll show my political stripes here, but a Ronald Reagan kind of religion. You know, and that I am very uncomfortable with the idea that says somebody else will pick what theology would be taught in the schools, given the stamp of approval.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other side of this for me is the part, and I can't remember the name of the book now, but there's been a very influential book that says that, in fact, we have taken the idea of separation of church and state and changed it to silencing the agenda.
Yeah.
You know, because my understanding of that part of the Bill of Rights says that there cannot be a state-established religion, So there cannot be one that's given the stamp of the state is approved. But that's not the same as saying you can't talk about it.
Right.
So I kind of jumped in here when you said that you can't talk about religion in schools. That's absolutely not true.
Yeah, and I'm not. I think we can do. We need to find a way to be whole people. You know, kids need if they're asked to write an essay on the person they most admire, it ought to be okay for them to talk about Jesus or St. Paul or Muhammad. Whereas in some schools, the teacher said, "Oh no, this you know," or if they wrote it, they're not allowed to. Even if it was the best paper, they can't stand up and read that paper in class. You know.
But I think if those kids took that case to court, they win. Our legal system would be on the side of the kid. They say, you can speak about it. The school system cannot give their stamp of approval.
It's right.
You know, you can't pick a pastor to speak at commencement or a priest to speak at a football game because that's the people in authority choose. But I'm very confident that if a student said, I chose to write about this and was told I could not write about this, if they got the ACLU on their side, they'd win.
Yeah.
That's where the law
comes. That would take some time. Happen. In our town, the local high school valedictorian last year had a speech about how important Jesus was in his life, and now the
But the valedictory speech is an official presentation. That's something that's established by your
usually approved by the principal.
Well, the different then what happened this year, the school system now is reading everybody's anything they're going to say at graduation.
I can understand how, I mean, that's in the Constitution, we have to do that, but just philosophically, we need to allow ourselves to be whole people. We need to allow our children to claim their wholeness. And it seems as though, you know, particularly for Lutherans, and I'm sure there are some non-Lutherans here, but we have any of the mainline denominations are just a little skittish about this. We don't want to talk about politics in church, and we don't want to bring religion, even our faith into the political arena, because if we kind of open the door, you know, Jerry Falwell's going to jump in there and go haywire. But it seems as though that there are other communities seem to be able to do this without any problem. One is the African American community, and when they talk about politics in church, and it's very very common for black religious leaders to be very much involved in politics, and nobody bats an eye, nobody complains about it. Well, as in Philadelphia, the black clergy of Philadelphia were a powerful political force. And did a lot of things in partnership with the city. Every black church that was on the ball had a 501(c) corporation that was not religious that could receive public funds and get involved way before George Bush started talking about faith-based initiative. I'm not sure exactly how this is going to play out, but the African American church mixes religion and politics all the time, and they get away with it, and they seem to do it well, and they seem to live, you know, more fully. They seem to be able to claim their wholeness in a way that we can't, and I think we can learn from them.
What about the
Sandler? I think in part that's because the black community in the United States still goes to church, mm-hmm. and I mean, I'm 51 years old. I went to public school in Minnesota, and we never started classes with prayer. We did not have the Ten Commandments on the wall. And Catholic kids had permission to leave and go to their church for religious instruction,
yeah.
But it wasn't part of the school. And then I became a teacher, and I know in the 70s, I noticed that a shift happened in our culture. Whereas when I was growing up, if there was a school bond issue, it always passed. Mm-hmm. And none has passed since then, which was part of the Affluenza movie, that a rich city like Colorado Springs has not passed a school bond issue since 1974.
Yeah.
But But white people used to go to church, which is becoming less common, so that I get a little uncomfortable with putting so much emphasis on our schools being responsible for religious instruction, when I think in the good old days,
yeah,
there was still a distinction between school and religion, but parents took responsibility for the religious instruction of their children in a way that's not happening anymore. But there was, at least in my experience growing up in a public school in the North, there was a common cultural covenant about civil behavior that I think we're losing. And I know as a teacher, I don't know if, now I'm a minister, and more we're talking about the uncivil behavior of people in churches toward each other as well, but there's some kind of breakdown happening in terms of just common decency and respect. And when I went to school, my parents told me to mind the teacher. Now it's more often...
Sue the teacher. Yeah, I'm concerned with, and just I'm really concerned about the kind of, as a pastor, I need to be concerned about public education because of confirmation, you know, and I've talked kind of a mixed group. The kids all go to different schools, and the kids that come from public school, even if they've been in regular Sunday school attenders, are idiots. When it comes to, you ask them to look up a Bible verse, is that the Old Testament or the New Testament? And thank goodness, every year there would be a couple of kids from Redeemer Lutheran who just were amazing. And so we would work as a group, and they would become resources to the other kids. But the difference, just in terms of their, Sunday school isn't enough, you know. And I don't know what the solution is. I just know that there's something seriously wrong, that our assumption that the kind of the way we've defined separation of church and state in this country is good, and not only is it working for us, which it isn't, but that we want to sort of export that to other countries. This is the American way, and the way you folks ought to do it too. We need to find a way, and I don't know what that way is, a way to claim our wholeness in public debates, in the schools, in the government, so that we can be our whole full self, bring our faith with us into the public arena. Yeah.
I'm just going to throw out one idea, because separation of church and state in our country is a given, and it was established for excellent reasons. It has created a situation which we have just this phenomenal diversity and in our midst, which is a positive thing. But then trying to say, okay, how can we do something creative with that other than just silencing? I like the idea of the silencing of the curriculum or something like that, because up until now, the method has been, okay, we have diversity, we have separation of church and state, so we just keep our mouths shut and don't.
Why can't we have the diversity and still talk about our faith, still be people of faith?
What I would propose, like for instance, for one example, is as far as I can remember, regular high school education is always included in a required class on world history or so forth. Why could we not have required classes in high school, in every high school, on world religions, which is not there necessarily to promulgate faith or to propose any particular faith, but so that there could be some discussion or correspondence between the impact of religious consciousness in the world and in the country, along with what their history is, along with what the foreign policy is, and just kind of something that could be taught in such a way that people at least know what these religions represent and why people feel so strongly about them.
Yeah, I think the opposite has happened. And in fact, the religious motivations and religious sensibilities of the so-called founding fathers have been sort of cut out of the textbooks, and that's de-emphasized. And economic and political issues raised to the fore.
I was a history teacher at eighth grade level, and I remember probably 10, 12 years ago starting to teach about the differences between the Muslim movement and how fast it spread in Christianity. And immediately a couple of kids in the class said, "You can't teach religion in this school." I said, "I'm teaching history, not religion."
Yeah.
And I made it clear, I was completely ethical about it, but see, you're challenged by not only students, but parents as well. And I'm not going to take it out of the curriculum just because some people object to it. That's part of world history.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, what's the fastest growing faith in the United States? Islam.
Yeah, and I found, I've been at forums in Philadelphia schools where they've invited faith community leaders to kind of get involved somehow. And and folks from the Muslim community have felt very free to talk about their faith and their values and things like that. Black Muslims, for the most part, and don't hesitate. Whereas, you know, that's not right. You know, some of in my upbringing and maybe part of my tradition, I don't feel as maybe because we've sort of as sort of the majority, because we're concerned about sort of respecting minorities and things like that, and concerned about proselytizing others. We don't want to do that. So we don't say anything, but the Black Muslims feel they you know talk about Muhammad and Elijah Muhammad
the Muslims in our local mosque invite people in once a year. It was just a week or two ago, and go over and we sit at a table, they serve us and go through all that for people that. But I think a lot of us that go are those people that know Islam and have lived in Islamic countries anyway. So it's kind of the preaching to the choir. But at least they open it up and say, you know, come and learn about it.
I think the fear is we're trying to convert one another instead of just having a dialogue and just talking about our faith without trying to proselytize anybody.
Yeah. How much time do we spend in our churches learning about Muslim faith?
Yeah.
Last summer at Holden, we had several sessions where we had people who were Muslim. We also have Jewish people who explained their faith, and how often do we bring, not go to them, but how often do we bring them to us?
Yeah, how often do we discuss? That's just sort of, don't ask, don't tell.
Last year, though, the women, Lutheran women today had a couple months on the Muslim religion, but other than that, it hasn't been around.
Yeah, how much do we understand? We don't. Mm-hmm.
What about our stamp on the coins here, in God we trust? I guess if they're so persnickety, the people that don't believe in that, then just tell them don't use the money.
I would. As a matter of fact, my alma mater, Brown University, their motto is in God we trust, in Latin, in Deo Speramus. And the story goes that the Secretary of the Treasury was visiting there and said, "Oh, isn't that nice?" and decided to put that on a coin. I was upset when I went back to my last reunion to see that in Deo Speramus, in God we trust, is sort of disappearing from the university crest. Some of the new buildings are going up and don't have that on. It's just sort of fading away. And I would guess if somebody raised a constitutional challenge that I think that's probably unconstitutional to have God we trust on our coinage.
Does it get public money, though? Because if it doesn't get public money, it can put anything in
it. It can, but they didn't want to. And I mean, it does. I guess they get research grants, they get student loans and stuff like that. Sure, they get public money.
Probably every private institution does. I mean, private college.
Harvard. The Harvard motto, it just says Veritas is their thing. Originally it was in Christ is truth, but somewhere along the line, maybe when the Unitarians took over, the in Christ part was sort of obliterated. It just says Veritas now, just truth. But this is America. I don't think that's going to change. But you know, we don't want to impose our faith on everybody else, but we at least need to be able to talk about it as a whole people. A teacher ought to be able to say, when I was in church Sunday, our pastor told this story, and I'll share it with the children and get their response or something like that, without trying to convert them to be Lutherans, but just to share their life as whole people of faith. And we're afraid to do that. We don't know how to do it. Joe Lieberman could do it. Everybody was, why, Joe Lieberman's talking about God all the time. How about that, you know? Why can't we?
Is there any law that says people have to live in the United States if they are so disruptive and they figure we're screwed up so bad? Is there some law that says they can't move to Canada or over to China?
Well, as a matter of fact, there are. It's not that easy to move to Canada.
Right.
Yeah, and there is a law that says that they can stay here if they want to.
Tomorrow I can't get up and move to Canada?
Nope, not without a visa.
Move there, live there.
Huh? Not without a visa?
Oh, yeah.
The Canadians will not yet.
They will, too.
Well, but I mean, you can't just...
We were right over here to Vancouver, B.C., and I know a guy that had a big motor home drive-in down there in Los Angeles, and he sold it, and he moved up to Vancouver. And you know what? He's retired, and they even give him retirement money. He just moved up there. So don't say they can't do it. They do it to damn please.
It's probably easier if you're retired.
If you're retired, you live in a motorhome, sure you can. But
He owned a big motorhome park down there. You know.
But I don't think that's the answer. I think if you're upset with the Lutheran Church or the Methodist Church or the United States or your government, you work to change it. You don't say get out of here.
I suspect a lot of it's self-censorship. I mean, you said that a lot. Why can't we do this? Why can't we do this?
Yeah, Jesse Jackson does. Joe Lieberman does.
We can. We just have to somehow teach ourselves. And it's jarring. It just once accidentally, I don't know, just kind of spurted out without me thinking about it. Somebody said something about, I think this was something about how somebody was, somebody at a retail store said something about now and this, you know, this amount of their bills for the governor or something like that for taxes. And I just kind of said, well, you know, I kind of like to pay those taxes. This person just snapped at me, you know, just kind of head snapped.
Yeah.
I said, well, you know, I'm kind of theologically inclined to pay taxes. I think that pays for things we need and stuff like that, right? And it was just like, change the subject, right? You know, don't talk about it, you know? And then afterwards I thought, how did that happen? You know, how did I make a theological statement in a regular setting? Yeah. You know, if somebody says something to you about capital punishment, how many times have you looked at it and said, well, my theological position on this is I think it's wrong to kill people who don't have to?
Keep those opinions to yourself. If that's part of your faith, fine, but it doesn't...
But we can say that.
Sure. And we should. I mean, we need to be whole people.
Well, I think one other thing that needs to be challenged is this idea that if you don't talk about your religion, then there is no religion. And that's actually not true, because if everybody kind of keeps, you know, quiet about whatever their personal faith might be, we still have a state religion, which could be described as either secularism or humanism, or consumerism, or capitalism. Mm-hmm. It's not like there's nothing there. It's, you know, there's a default position.
Right.
And if you can't talk about your spiritual faith, then you're just opting for the default, however you might define it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But on the other hand, I work for a tax-supported school. I mean, I completely agree with you. And my supervisor happens to be a born-again Christian, and I just keep my mouth shut because she's my supervisor, and I'm not going to disagree with some of the things that she kind of puts down on us, with which I disagree. So here's a place where I feel this conflict of not of obeying my conscience, but I'm not going to discuss religious values with her.
Yeah, and we really don't know how to dialogue about that.
I think a big part of the problem in schools is the textbook publishers, because textbook publishing is dominated by just a few companies. And in some states, textbooks are chosen at the state level. I think Texas is
like Texas, right. Yeah.
And the textbook publishers, in order to sell the most textbooks, they try to remove everything that's possibly controversial.
Sure.
They try to remove everything that anybody might object to. They'll take it out if a liberal objects to it. They'll take it out if a conservative objects to it. And what we're left with is really bland and boring textbooks that don't talk about any controversial subjects. And a lot of our history is being left out. I would recommend anybody here read a book called Lies My Teacher Told Me, which is about history. And it's about things that have been left out of our history books because people object to it, because it doesn't tell the nice, pretty story, the patriotic story that we want everybody to learn. I've heard that there are some textbooks that don't, for example, don't mention the fact that Martin Luther King was an ordained minister. They'll take religion out of it.
Sure.
And they're doing that kind of stupidly, because it's not illegal to mention those things, but they just want to make sure they don't offend anybody.
In Philadelphia, near Independence Hall, they've restored a lot of buildings that you can tour. One of them is Bishop White's residence. He was the first Episcopal bishop in the U.S., and they conduct tours through there, and they've, you know, put period furniture and stuff. There is absolutely no indication in the furnishings or the decorations that he was a Christian. You know, the bishop of the Episcopal Church, you expect to see like a crucifix or something, or the Bible opened on his nightstand or something like that. Not a religious book, not a religious symbol in the entire house. And I asked the park service. They said, "Well, we just wanted to show how a typical upper class person lived, you know, during the colonial times." But this is Bishop White's house. But absolutely, been any kind of hint of his faith is totally absent.
We're at 11:45, so.
Okay, we are done. Thank you. And I just want to say, on Friday, I'll be in this room at 5, but I'll be showing a video on a same-sex wedding at St. Francis. We're going to talk about claiming wholeness in our thinking about committed relationships. I'm going to take a look at it now to sort of preview it and think of some questions. If anybody would like to, I know some people aren't going to be here Friday, would want to see it anyway. It's about a 20-minute film. Anybody would like to see it, it's welcome to stay and help
Where
me.
Where is St. Francis?
Say again?
Where is St. Francis?
It's in San Francisco, in the middle of the gayest neighborhood in North America.
Okay, I picked up you said gayest neighborhood, but I didn't.
Yeah, it's in the middle of the what's called the Castro. So
does anybody read the Bible?
Huh?
Does anybody read the Bible?
In San Francisco?
Here or there.
Oh, sure. We read it very...
Same-sex marriage and stuff.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, well, then you know what the results are of that. It's very simple. It's printed in black and white, right in the Bible.
We don't read the Bible.
Different places.
We don't hit people over the head with our Bibles. We interpret it with
love. Interpretation and fact and figures. You know, I went to school where I learned that the means something and you mean something and I mean something. It's all a matter of knowing English. And interpretation is a bunch of hooey when you can read it very plain and simple.
But the Bible was written in English.
If you're interested in talking about that, come to my session tomorrow. We'll be looking at the variety of sexualities as described, particularly in the Old Testament. So that's a big issue. And we'll
start right out in Romans 1, and it just takes a few minutes.
What time is that tomorrow?
Tomorrow at 3:45. Yeah, well, we'll talk about that tomorrow. How do we read the Bible? The reading of sensitivity and understanding the context to whom it was written and understanding. There's a lot of sex in the Bible. It's not all the nuclear family. There's polygamy, incest, there's love, Naomi and Ruth, between David and Jonathan.
What time is your session tomorrow?
I think it's It's at 3:45. I'm just going to sort of preview it, and I'm going to maybe you can help me.
You need Friday.
Okay.
So I want to see it now.
I could use some help to say this is about 20-minute film. What would be some good discussion questions to ask people after?
Just a footnote to your comment about having a religious advisory governmental offices. I've always felt familiar with historians in perhaps the Security Council on that level. So I think it's just totally ignoring the history of the
Yeah, that's a lot of, we get a lot of bad things.